Blog Talk Radio.
You know that the ice cream scoop can make a child smile, and that by slowing us down, the traffic light can keep us going. You know that the lawnmower makes life easier, that the blood bank makes life possible. But did you know all these ideas came from the minds of African Americans? Support the United Negro College Fund, because a mind is a terrible thing to waste. Visit uncf.org or call 1-800-332-UNCF. Brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.
Good morning and welcome to the second half of Saturday Mornings with Joy Keyes. I'm your host, Joy Keyes. Thank you for tuning in. I'm over here on the East Coast in Philadelphia getting ready for this hurricane. As far as I know, they lost power in North Carolina and it's making its way up the coast. I hope everybody will be safe and secure during this crazy time. We have no idea what's going to happen, if it's really going to happen or not, you know. But today, at this moment, we're going to be speaking with a wonderful author. She's not only an author, she's a publisher, a filmmaker, a teacher, a journalist. She grew up in the middle of Georgia in the 50s. She has several novels out. You might have heard of Baby of the Family, Ugly Ways, The Hand I Fan With, a little erotic novel there, and You Know Better. She's also launched a publishing company in 2007, Down South Press, which she published Taking After Madeira, which is a sequel to the best-selling book Ugly Ways. She's also working on a film with her husband on Baby of the Family. We're going to be featuring some wonderful actors and actresses, Alfre Woodard, Loretta Devine, Shirley Ralph, Vanessa Williams, Todd Bridges, Pam Grier, a lot of wonderful people on that. So you want to check her out and listen this morning. The call-in number is 646-929-0368. I believe she's on the line right now. Good morning.
I am indeed. Good morning, Joy.
Thank you so much for calling in today.
Oh, it's my joy, Joy. I'm happy to do it. I know you get that a lot, huh?
I get that a lot. That's okay. You know, it's a blessing. My grandmother gave me the name Joy, so hopefully it's serving me well. Only my friends know if I'm a joy or not.
Well, that's a lovely gift. I always say it's my joy. My husband, I'll tell you a quick story. My husband's a filmmaker, and his studio is next door to the house. And when I was writing The Hand I Fan With, as you have pointed out, my erotic third novel, the story of Lena and Herman, having a good time in Mulberry, I was on the other side of the house, and I heard my husband calling me, "Terry, babe, and I went running because, you know, we're at that time of life when, you know, something could be happening. And I go in, and I go in the offices, and I go all the way around the house, and I go in, and he looks at me and said, "Babe, would you make me a sandwich?" And Joy, you know, upping me. You know, I wanted to say, look, I am trying to write a best-selling novel in here. You know, what are you talking about? You know, I am Tina McElroy. All that came up, but I reached real deep, and I said, "Sure, babe, it's my joy." Now, whenever we do something to each other that we really don't want to do, we always say, "Sure, babe, it's my joy." So I have to tell you, my joy to be on your show and not like making my husband a sandwich, but a real joy.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. I feel honored. You're a wonderful author. I had an opportunity to read the Ugly Ways and Taking Them with Deer. I haven't had a chance to read all the other books, but I have read a lot about them. And some of the issues, since you brought up, you know, your husband, you deal with relationships of men and women. And I guess also the issue of freedom and control between the different characters. Talk to me about I don't want to say it's an obsession with you in terms of the different storylines, but there's a lot of that of delving into the relationship between men and women and who's the leader, who's following, and the joy that they can bring each other, if you want to go to The Hand I Fan With, but also in other relationships, in Taking a Madeira and Ugly Ways, there was joy in the relationship in the beginning, and then, you know, they lost it. Talk to me about that, why you bring that up so much in your books, the relationships between men and women.
I have to tell you, it's taken after Mudia insists that I go around telling people how to say it.
Okay.
About family. So I write about family, you know, and that really is what it is. I write a great deal about mothers and daughters over and over again, and I really was writing about it before I realized that was so, you know, deep in my writing. But I write, Toni Morrison has said this, and other writers say it as well. I write what I want to read, and I write about what, you know, heart. you know, 15, 20 years ago, writing about relationships and what's going on and what you wake up in the middle of the night caring about and that thing that, you know, you didn't know whether you made the right decision, did you, you know, choose the right person, all of that. You know, that used to be, quote, unquote, women's work. You remember that? Like 20, 50 years ago? Now everybody is writing. You look at the bestseller list, that is what it's about, whether it's a historical novel, whether whatever it is, because, we, you know, this is the beginning of a new century. And this is what people care about. You know, that stuff that you do wake up in the middle of the night wondering about, all that inner stuff, all that inside stuff, you know, that stuff that's wrapped all around your heart. And I think, I want to write literature. My aim is to write literature. You know, I want it to be accessible, but I want it to be meaningful and deep and rich, and I don't want people to read it and forget about it. You know how you, and there's some books that you want to do that. You read them on the beach, you know, you leave them in a hotel room, you know, you enjoy them, that was it. But I'm trying to write you know, reflects our lives, because I write about African-American people, reflects our lives, but also delves into the things that we care about. And what we care about is relationships, whether it's with your mother or with your man or with your sister or with your coworker. You know, that's at the root of everything that we care about. So that's what I write about. I write from a very woman-focused writer. You know, I'm proud to be a woman-focused writer. So I do write, as you pointed out, about control and who's in charge in the relationship, who gives you joy, you know, what's important, what do you just say, you know, screw that. Nobody cares about that, you know. I said something to him, and he misunderstood me, and then he said something to me, and I misunderstood him, and then we were going back, and I said, hey, look, we're too old to waste our time on this. I don't even care. Let's move on. You know, so you have to decide, well, this is deeply, deeply important to me. And if something is, you know, just, you know, forget this. You know, life is important. Right. So I want to write about all those things that people truly care about. And that that relationship thing is just so deep. I mean, it's what we do. No matter what's going on.
One of the things real quick you mentioned about that you do write from a woman's perspective, but also you're dealing with the history of African Americans, and you have a lot of spirituality in your books. One of the things you bring up about many of the babies being born with veils, and that's a sign of foresight. Talk to the audience a little bit about that belief of the babies being born with veils.
Yeah, Baby of the Family is my first novel, and it's the story of Lena McPherson, who is a child born in a small middle Georgia fictional town called Mulberry. And she is indeed the baby of the family, and she's special in that way. But what really makes her special is she's born with a caul or a veil over her face. And that's a thin membrane. It's really part of the birth sac. There's some children are born with, when they come out, it's covering their head, face, their heads, or sometimes their whole bodies. And joy in every culture in the whole world, whether it's in Japan or whether it's in the Caribbean or France or England, if there are beliefs attached to a child born with a caul or a veil, this thin membrane. And the belief is it changes from culture to culture, but basically it's the child is special, connected to the supernatural, can see ghosts, can tell the future, you know, can look at you and, you know, tell what's going on with you, you know. And in some Native American cultures, you know, that's who becomes the shaman. You know, that's the person who is revered in the community. You know, sometimes that person is an outsider. In Charles Dickens' works, David Copperfield was born with a caul. You know, you find the caul mentioned in Frank McCourt's works, and, you know, from Ireland, Angela's Ashes. I mean, it's just everywhere. And I was born with a caul, so I grew up hearing all this stuff. I grew up in Macon, Georgia, in middle Georgia town, at a time, you know, when black folks, you remember when black folks, I know you're young, but do you remember when you talked to your grandmother, when black folks used to be so unselfconscious about being black? You remember that? I mean, well, you know, we talked about tips and watermelon and stuff. I mean, you know, once we moved into the...
Now you can't, now you're talking to the city, you can't bring up, people are sometimes afraid to eat fried chicken.
Absolutely.
Watermelon in front of a white person because they don't want, well, that's too black. But you know what? Watermelons have a lot of water and nutrition in them, so that's why people were eating them. And, you know, fried chicken is easy to make. It wasn't just for black people, but that becomes self-conscious.
Yeah. But, I mean, you know, but again, I remember at that time, and I live on a small island off the coast of Georgia, St. Simon's Island, 4 miles by 12 miles, in a little town on the mainland across from the the bridge is Brunswick, Georgia. And we've been here
With the Gullah people. The Gullah people. Talk to us a little bit about the Gullah people.
Absolutely. You know, there's a string of sea islands that start in the Carolinas and come all the way to North Florida. And these sea islands, number one, they're physically beautiful. You know, there's Spanish moss on the tree, on the live oak trees, and beautiful beaches, and, you know, saltwater marshes. So it's physically beautiful, but it's also African-American people so rich in our culture, because the sea islands were where during slavery, where black people who lived and worked as slaves had some sense of isolation from the coast. So they were able to keep a lot of their Africanisms, you know, the way they cooked, and the Sweetwater sweetgrass baskets that people, you know, in Charleston, people buy, the casting nets, making batu boats, and all these kinds of
things.
They
were also the slaves were, Tina, the slaves were, from my reading and research, they were left there under other slaves, you know, like field hands.
Yeah, during plantation times, white people thought that they were very afraid of malaria and afraid of mosquitoes. And because African people had a gene that actually
protected them,
exactly. What white folks would do, the slave owners would move into the pine forest during the summer, during the hot months. And it's hot like from here from, you know, like April to December. And so they would move in and leave. Sometimes they would leave a white overseer, and sometimes they would leave a black overseer, you know, for months alone. You know, and so they were alone. When I say that isolation, I mean it in a good way. They were isolated from the coast, and they also had isolation from, you know, from white folks who were telling them what they could keep and what they couldn't. So, you know, their language and the words and the way they cooked and all the rest, you know, that was kept in ways that it wasn't kept on the mainland, you know, where you couldn't have drums and, you know, you couldn't keep your name and you couldn't keep your history and, you know, all these kinds of things. So there's a rich Geechee Gullah, this is what it's called, a rich Geechee Gullah history that is, especially the South Carolina and, you know, St. Helena and Dusky Island, and down here it's Sapelo Island. Sapelo is a wonderful, wonderful place. If anybody ever gets down here, you know, Sapelo Island is a fairly undeveloped island. I have a writing retreat that I've held on Sapelo Island for three or four years. And it's a perfect place for a writer's retreat because, you know, there are no grocery stores, there are no drug stores, there are no, you know, movie places, there are no street lights. So, you know, what you're doing is just immersed in the culture for African-American people. You're immersed in the culture and the richness that is there. You know, Joy, is down here, our stuff just seems to hang in the air. You know, when you go to Savannah.
Now, wait a second. You know, I'm a Tina. I got to defend the Yankees. I'm a Yankee, okay? We got a lot of stuff up here, too.
But I'm not saying it's the only place, but down here, you know, there really is. You know, have you been to places where you can just feel our people? You know, you can just feel.
Oh, yeah. I was in Atlanta in the spring. I took my daughter down there. She's interested in going to a college down there, SCAD, Savannah College of Art and Design. And trust me, I felt different in Atlanta than I say I walk around in Philadelphia. I did. I felt proud to be, you know, an African American because I saw a lot of African Americans in positions of power. So that was very happy. Just being there, it is a difference. I did see a lot of Ethiopians when I was in Atlanta. That was interesting. So let's talk about the land a little bit, because you bring up the land, gardening, nature, flowers and plants in a lot of your novels. And you're a gardener. Is that why it came out in the novels, you think, because you yourself are a gardener?
You know, partly that. I think, you know, when you go to writing retreats, you know, the thing that you hear all the time, or writing, you know, workshops, is write what you know. And that doesn't mean to write biography. You know, you're not just regurgitating, you know, what you've lived. But you write what you know so well that people think that it's biography. You know, when people ask me about your grandmother, and I said, well, I didn't have a grandmother. My grandmother died, but I always wanted one, so I created one in my fiction. So in the same way that, you know, I'm a gardener, that's meaningful to me. The land is meaningful to me. You know, being a gardener has changed me. You know, putting a seed in the ground and seeing a plant grow and, you know, feeding my family from that and sharing it with neighbors. But the other thing about that is it's my history. You know, I'm a Southerner. This is what we come from. You know, this is what we used to have, you know, gardens. I see pictures of Vernal Hurston, who was one of my, you know, literary mothers. And I see photographs of her, especially later in her life, you know, sitting out in the yard. And, you know, there's a garden there. It's just so important for people of color, especially, but people who have a sense of connection to the land. And Southerners have a special, not that they are the only people, but I think Southerners have a special connection to the land. So, you know, most African American people in this country came from the South. Their ancestors in some way, you know, migrated to the South. I just read, this past year, I read Isabel Wilkerson.
Yeah, she was on the show. Yeah. She's a wonderful, wonderful, sweeping novel. Excellent, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, you know, we kind of all came from here. So I write about that because I know it, literally know it because I'm a gardener, but I also write about it because that's part of my history and part of what I write about. It's something that anchors us yeah. to, you know, to who we are. I have to tell you, I was just working on a press kit for my author. This fall we're publishing, Down South Press, my publishing company, is publishing a debut novelist. Tarsha Stanley, and her book is called The Book of Ephesus. Her novel is called
The
Book of Ephesus.
Well, she's going to have to come on the show. Tina, she's going to have to come on the show.
But I was just writing, and one of the quotes that she has, she's from North Carolina, is that she's mostly lived in, she's the chairman of the English department at Spelman College, and she's written nonfiction, but this is her first work of fiction. It's a love story. It's the tagline is, A Woman of God, A Stranger, A Love Story. It's definitely a beautiful love story, but I was working on her press kit, and one of the things that I had a quote from her is that she said she had lived a lot of, you know, wanted to live a lot of places, but she had mostly lived in the South. She said the Southern soil just wouldn't let her go.
Mm-hmm,
and I thought that was so beautiful because, I've mostly lived in the South, too, and I feel that same way. So, on the one hand, I'd like to write on a level, I hope that my work is like a tort or a casserole, you know, where you have a level of onions, a level of celery, a level of potatoes, a level of
chicken. Definitely. I mean, you have a lot in there. We talk about the spirituality. We talk about you have a lot of environmental issues in there because I hear your concern for the land. And as you said, once you get into the land, you appreciate it and you realize the importance of it. I know when I was younger, my mom used to send me out to Doylestown, which is like a further suburbs in Pennsylvania, and it was like my godmother, she had a couple acres of land. She used to grow peaches and collard greens. She used to make her own jams. I used to go out there. She had carrots. She had onions. I mean, there's nothing like fresh food from the ground. She had apples, and just being able to run freely as a kid. I used to have a bike. The kids in the city don't have that, and that, I think, affects you psychologically. If you're only around the stone and the brick, and closed, confined quarters with skyscrapers, you ever get to the green. You never get to the green. It really affects your life, I think, and your perspective. I mean, what do you think, Tina?
I'm so interested in just what you said, and in the environment, in the sense that what's around you shapes you, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The kids in the city as opposed to kids in the country. And, you know, there's nothing new. There's nothing new under the sun. As it's written in the Bible, and you know, when you read about Whole Foods and the new, you know, local.
That's old news. You know, that's old news. Yeah, we people knew that.
There's nothing, and we were healthy. I mean, you know, look at how we got through. Look at how we got over. And one of the reasons, you know, I think certainly we eat too much grease. You know, we eat too much pork. But, you know, balancing that out, you know, if you came from the country, you came from the South at a certain time when I was younger, you know, everybody had a little garden in their yard. The other thing is that it's so smart, you know, economically, you know. You go to Whole Foods or you even go to the farmer's market and fresh vegetables, you know, fresh fruit, collard greens, all that, you know, are fairly expensive. You know, and if
very
you have a
garden, yeah,
you can go outside, you know, buy a dollar or 50-cent pack of collard green seeds,
you know, and you have
collard greens all year long. I have a neighbor, Mr. Buck, who has collard greens that are truly plant stalks that are like 5 years old. He just keeps cropping them from the top of me, from the bottom. sometimes they get tough. But Mr. Buck, he's in his 90s. Mr. Buck has been gardening in the same spot at least 50, 60 years, and he just knows so much. You know, the other thing is we used to be smart people. You remember that, Joy? I mean, we used to be people of excellence. Some of them are people, black folks, who used to be people of excellence.
Well, I think Tina, I think one of the things that people, and it goes in cycles, is the internal oppression that we put on ourselves and believing that we as African Americans are not capable, did not know how to do things, were only slaves. But back in the day, I was just telling a young sister, she's probably in her early 20s, I was saying, you know, there were doctors and lawyers because we couldn't go to the white doctor, we couldn't go to the white lawyer. There were, you know, women in the community helping with health, there, you know. We had stuff because we had to have stuff. You couldn't go anywhere else. So they were smart people, you know. Let me tell you, there's a question real quick before I forget from the chat room. Someone is asking, did you feel nervous about writing Taking After Madea since Ugly Ways was written? And then the second part was, how did it feel that having to revisit those characters? So it was a two-part question. Did you feel nervous about writing Taking After Madea? And then how did it feel revisiting?
Yeah, no, I am blessed as many writers are. You know, I'm never nervous about writing what I know I'm supposed to be writing. You know, when I feel that it's time to do it. Ugly Ways was published in 1993, and that was a while ago. And Taken After Madea was published in 2007. And I never, you know, when I finish a novel, I'm finished with it. You know, I know that my readers love my characters and that they're smart people, you know, and that they, you know sort of think. I like to think, oh, okay, what happened next, you know, and I let my imagination go, you know, at the end of a novel. And I know people that thought, okay, what happened to the Lovejoy sisters, you know, are they still crazy, you know, is Andrew's
yeah.
baby and all of that. But I really didn't think of writing, you know, a sequel because it's sort of over unless those characters come back to me and sort of say, you know, we have.
They haunt you. Do the characters sometimes, do you feel like they're haunting you, they're still there?
Well, in a good kind of way. You know, the women of
Yeah, in a good way, in a good way.
Yeah. And the women of Ugly Ways are sort of high maintenance. You know what I mean? They're kind of yapping in your ear, listen to my story, this is what Madea said, this is what she did to me, this is what happened on my prom night. But, you know, Lena and Herman from The Hand I Stand With are like beautiful people to spend time with. They're just lovely and they love each other. So characters, you know, are different. But with Ugly Ways, it's so interesting. I've sold more copies probably of Ugly Ways, my second novel, which is the story of the Lovejoy women. You know, three girls, three women who come home to Mulberry, Georgia to bury their selfish, self-focused mother who has the nerve to be.
Oh, she was evil. I did not like her. But you know what? At the same time, and this is something we can talk about mental health and nervous breakdown. I do shows about black people and mental health. She needed some help. She needed some help. So did the husbands. So did the sisters. But nobody was going to get help. And so people just hated her. But once you learn her story, like the older sister knew what would have happened and what had changed her in a sense. But the younger sisters didn't. But just let me talk about the mental health issue in African-American community. It's a serious problem that people don't want to go get help. They're afraid to go get help. I think if you're dealing with somebody, you need to present them with some options, some resources, you know.
Oh, absolutely. I wish I could think of the title of the book. You may know Cherry Williams wrote a book a few years ago.
Oh, yeah, she was on the show. Black Pain talked about that, yep.
Absolutely. And it is, you know, sort of traditionally we would say, oh, no, don't go to no psychiatrist. No, that's what white folks do. That's what crazy white women do. You know, and still being crazy and needing some help. You know, on the one hand, you pick up, you're so insightful, Joy. You pick up that Madea certainly needed some, you know, psychological help, but she also, there was also a reason that she was the way that she was, you know, and I think that that's important, too, in fiction, in everybody's fiction. I'm going to say in our fiction, but fiction, that it's not just a story, that there's something there, there's something to think about, there's something to talk about. I talk to book clubs many times, and they'll say, you know, well, we read so-and-so, and, it, you know, it'll be like, you know, the baby mama drama, baby girls around the block, girls spelled with a Z. You know, that pisses me off for some reason, it's spelled with a Z.
Yeah.
But there's nothing there. And I asked them, okay, after you talk about what he did to her on page 34 and what she said.
But why did he do it? Why did he do it? There's an underlying story. Why he went and went off and slapped her inside the head, or why she stole his money, or what? That's the interesting story, a subtext.
Well, you know, the thing is that's our job. That's the job of the author to put things in there. You know, I tell people all the time, well, it's not your job, you know, to have to keep digging and digging and digging. I should at least, as the author, have put enough in there for you to discuss and to decide, okay, this is, to, you know, for yourself, this is why she was this way. And so somebody else can say, well, no, I didn't think so. You know, I thought that this was the way. That, I mean, that's what a rich discussion about books is, you know, that you have your opinion, Joy, and I have mine. You have your insight, I have mine. You have your viewpoint, and we come together and talk about it. But the author has to put all that stuff. John Oliver Gale,
yeah.
who wrote Cotillion and Youngblood, he grew up in Macon, Georgia. He was one of the founders of the Harlem Writers Group, and you know where Nikki Giovanni and all the number of people came out of Maya Angelou. But he was my homeboy. He grew up in Macon, Georgia. But one of the things, I took a workshop with him before he passed, and one of the things he used to say is that the author's job is, can I say shit?
Yes, that's all right. We won't be cut off.
Okay. He said the author's job is to put more shit in the game, more shit in the game, more shit in the game. And that really is what it is. It's the author's job to put more tension and more friction and more, you know, information and more, you know, confusion, you know, just to put more tension, more stuff in there, more stuff. And that's what I'm talking about.
It makes the reader think. That Tina, that makes the reader think. It's like a piece of visual artwork. Like you said, I'm going to stand in front of this book and read it, and I'm going to have one perception, but another person will read it, have another perception, the third person have another perception. I mean, that's when you know it's the rich literature, that you can get four or five different perspectives, you know?
And the other thing is, I have this, I've been writing for more than 20 years now, and I have people who tell me that I read Baby of the Family when I was in high school, and then I read it again, you know, when I had my first child, and I felt something different, and then I read it again when I got a divorce. You know, they say the same thing about, you know, all my work, and that's so thrilling for an author, that you can go back, just like you said, like a masterpiece, like an artwork, that you can look at it and see something, and then you go back and look at it again and go, oh, my goodness, I didn't even see that before. You know, and that's what I find exciting about, you know, about really good, rich literature. You know, and I tell folks all the time, you know, it doesn't have to be Toni Morrison, where you need a dictionary and an encyclopedia and, you know, a Greek mythology.
You can just talk straight. Yes.
But it can be rich in the sense that, you know, there is a lot to discuss in there. There are things that, you know, resonate with you because you're a teenager. And then you read it later on and, you know, you've grown up and you see something else and, you know, that resonates with you. You know, it's a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful thing when authors do the work. Authors do the work.
Tina, let me just real quick, let me tell the audience a little bit about some of the things you've been doing philanthropy-wise. They may not be aware of your connection with South Africa. You had a book-sharing program collecting books signed by African-American women authors, and you shared them with South African women. Also, you're involved in homeless issues. That's a big issue in our country that we kind of avoid, but that's something that's out there. I had a show actually with Oscar-winning director Bill Guttentag, and he was on here talking about homeless teenagers in California on the West Coast. And, you know, his book was Boulevard. I'm sorry?
I was just saying that's a real issue. Yeah
it's a very serious issue. Teenagers, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, being put, you know, so many teenagers. Now, things are different. You know, lots of young people are being put out, literally put out. You know, the families just can't deal with them anymore. They think that they're, you know, a problem. You know, unfortunately, a lot of women, you know, decide to take their men over their children, you know, choose men over their children. And, you know, a lot of them, there's abuse in the house, and they run away because, you know, they're trying to get away. You know, listen to what we've just been talking about, though, Joy. All these wonderful, rich issues, you know, that are just grist for the mill for authors. And, you know, that's why I'm so adamant.
You are so excited and so passionate. I can tell about your work and stories and sharing. And that's what comes across in your writing, because you have such rich writing. You talk about AIDS. You talk about LGBT issues. You talk about mental health issues. You talk about spirituality. You talk about sexuality. You talk about power, control, freedom. I think that's something that comes through. Everybody wants to feel free. They want to be released of their burdens. I think that's what's coming, another layer in your work. Talk to me about that issue of freedom.
Well, you know, that resonates for me. I think it resonates for especially for African American women. I think it resonates especially for anybody who's been marginalized, you know, in this country. African American folks, Hispanic folks, you know, Asian Americans, Native Americans. There's that set of women, you know, that sense that human beings yearn to be free. Human beings mm-hmm. yearn to be who they are. And you can't yes. be who you know are intrinsically unless you do feel that sense of freedom, being able to live what you want to. And, you know, and that's a human thing. And to put that in my fiction is, you know, one of my aims, because it's important to discuss that and talk about it. We all feel so isolated, too, you know, to have, you know, all this access to social networking and all the rest of it. We really are very isolated, especially Americans, just in this the rural culture, in our own selves, thinking that we're the only ones who have crazy mamas. We're the only mm-hmm. ones who you know, sit up at night crying because we don't know what we want to do. You know, we're the only ones who, whatever, fill in the blank. And I think that the literature is, you know, that's why book clubs are so wonderful, because you in book clubs discussions you begin talking about the characters, but you almost always end up talking about yourself. And the thing I love about book clubs is that it's a safe. Always look at them as umbrellas. Any discussion as an umbrella,
a sacred space.
Literally, where you feel safe, where you can expose yourself. You know, I mean, you know, people are. Very, I can't think of the word. It's a perfect word, but anyway,
They think they're hiding information about themselves. But I always feel that we're very transparent. I think we're very transparent, but we think nobody can see, but everybody can see. And sometimes people see stuff they don't know what it is. They don't know how to label it. But Tina, we run out of time. I'm so sorry, but we run out of time. I want to thank you so much. You got to come back with the other young author you're publishing. Her new book.
I'd love to come back. And Tarsha's book is going to be on ebook in October, and it will be in trade paperback in November. You can go to my website, TinaMacLoreanza.com, or my publisher's website, DownSouthPress.com, or you can go to Tarsha's website, TarshaStanley.com. And read a first chapter of the book, and we would love for you to order the book. We'd love for you to support Down South Press in whatever way you can. And, you know, if you want me or Tarsha to come to your town, your book club, find a way to get us there. We can work it out, and I'll be there.
Thank you so much, Tina. I want to thank all the listeners in the chat room, the people calling in. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I'll be giving away to thankfully, Tina's been so gracious. She's offering up a couple of her books. So I'll be sending out a little contest. Stay tuned on Twitter and on Facebook. Become a fan if you're not on Facebook, and follow me on Twitter at Joy Keys, and you can win one of her books. Keep an eye out. Thank you so much, Tina. I wish you so much
success.
Definitely please bring the young lady back on the show. We'll have to set that up.
I'll be sure to do it. And you need to follow me on Twitter. I'm following you.
Yeah,
Joy.
She's
you
on Twitter. Yeah.
Thank you. Have a good day.
I'm not
Love
following you. Wait, I'm not following you. Oh, no, that's not good. Okay, yes, I have to do that.
Take care, dear. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Again, check out Tina's website. Tina has a wonderful website, and please support African-American people doing wonderful things. That's one of the tenets of Kwanzaa, supporting African-American businesses. So check out her Down South Press. Her website is her name, TinaMcElroyAnza.com, and then you can check out DownSouthPress.com. And, again, she has a new author coming out later in the fall on the press. You can check out the first chapter of the book. So please support African-American-owned businesses and a wonderful author. Thank you so much. Follow me on Twitter.com/JoyKeys. Become a fan on Facebook. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. And next Saturday, I'll be doing a show with one of what they call Forbes 50 Smartest African Businesswomen. She's from Ethiopia, and she has a shoe company called Soul Rebels. She was on the show before, but she's been doing a lot of wonderful things and has received a lot of wonderful accolades from the UN, from Forbes. She's coming on the show next Saturday. Later in the month, September, I'll be doing a show, The State of Young Black Men, with some wonderful black men on the show, professors from Kansas, from Lewis and Clark, from University of Washington, Vancouver, Thabiti Lewis, Derek Darby, Andre Brown and social worker Chad Dion Lasseter. So check that out. That's September 10th. Thank you so much. You have a wonderful Saturday.
You know that the ice cream scoop can make a child smile, and that by slowing us down, the traffic light can keep us going. You know that the lawnmower makes life easier, that the blood bank makes life possible. But did you know all these ideas came from the minds of African Americans? Support the United Negro College Fund, because a mind is a terrible thing to waste. Visit uncf.org or call 1-800-332-UNCF. Brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.